Who'd have thunk that between the two of us that you would become the master deck designer?
Hey, man. People are here for 7 techniques for unbeatable sideboarding. I think we should start with that.
All right. You win, master deck designer. Flores Friday, 7 techniques for unbeatable sideboarding. This is from May 13th, 2011. I won Writer of the Year that year.
Congrats. One quick note, I want to read the little introduction for the article. These methods are unconventional, but Mike Flores has never been about following the dotted lines. What matters is results. Mike suggests the following ways to get them through these 7 sideboarding techniques. Number 1. Pick a side. Have a purpose. Make a decision.
The word decide comes from the Latin to cut off. In English, the word is closely related to decision and decisive. What we are going to work on today is best accomplished, only accomplished really, when we begin from a particular point and perspective. Really worthless deck playtesting comes from a notion of exploration. How does this match play out? This is the opposite of the correct way of approaching playtesting if we're actually trying to make good sideboards or solve real problems. Did you know that 1 plus 2 equals 3? And that 2 plus 1 also equals 3? It's insane, right? Our playtesting and the information of our innovation should come from a place of advocacy, not objectivity or even exploration. It is perfectly okay for us to want one side to win. In fact, the whole rest of it is our laying out the path to get to the place we want to get. Who cares if 1 plus 2 equals 3 and that 2 plus 1 equals 3 if we are trying to get to 5? Remember, we control the inputs. Passivity and acceptance is a recipe for a mediocre life. What we want to do is to figure out how to turn a 10-90 matchup into a 90-10 one after sideboarding, as has been done time and again by sideboarding masters by eating up lots of space, killing their darlings, and rejecting, after first trying, bad idea after bad idea, but snapping the inputs in and out like Lego pieces ourselves.
Number 2, approach the process with a clear understanding of expectation.
Him, Underground C, Breakthrough for 0. You, Arg, Wooded Foothills, Crack It for Savannah, Wild the Cattle. Him, Lol, Dredge Golgari Grave Troll, flipping 3 Narco Amoebas, Dread Return, Flamekin Zealot, and 2 copies of Bridge from Below. You, Arg, you're so lucky. Him, yeah, because your Wild the Cattle was so gonna get me on turn 3. It happens every day. You can substitute whatever unplayable deck you want with whatever bad matchup you want, and it's ultimately all the same. You have a horrendous matchup in game 1 with a negligible win percentage. How can you proceed? Ignore it. Fight it. Ignoring it is a perfectly reasonable solution sometimes. Can you win a StarCityGames.com Legacy Open without ever facing Dredge or whatever your horrible matchup is? Yes. There are like 40 decks in Legacy, and the fact that Goblins, Zoo, and other Zoo so often make top 16 is a testament to the fact that tons and tons of players are willing to play unplayable decks, and you can hit each other all day in a merry-go-round of nobody having Force of Will or turn 3 kill. Hooray! Can you play through a Standard Open, or even a Standard Grand Prix without ever playing Cawblade? Also yes. Can you win one without playing against Cawblade? No. So, if your bad game 1 matchup is Cawblade and you plan to win the tournament, you have to have some powerful and repeatable mathematics if you have any hope of winning the tournament. How good is good enough? Well, sometimes you'll see deck designers write things like 50% against the field, or that they can get to 50% after sideboarding. This is awful. Never listen to these people. They don't understand math. A deck that is 50% against the field is a ticket to a 3-3. Do you think Edgar Flores with his 1 mana / 25 land Cawblade is looking for a fair mano a mano with everyone he sits against every week? No way. He is angle shooting and looking for an edge. So how much of an edge? Let's pretend you were the Zoo deck that isn't very good against the dredge deck, or substitute again whatever decks you want, with the understanding that some decks just never beat other decks in game one, unless something ooey-gooey is going on. Like lands against Cephalid Breakfast or something. When you have a negligible game one, and this should be obvious, you need to win both game two and game three in order to win the match. Let's say you win game two half the time. That would mean that you lose the match half the time after game two, and that you lose the whole thing 75% of the time. See why getting the match to 50% is pointless and it's a stupid thing no one should really ever even talk about? By the way, if you can, quote, get the match to 50%, I'm skeptical that your 50% even holds in game three when you are on the draw. So, how much is good enough again? Without getting into every scrap of math, though it isn't that hard actually, if you can win about two-thirds of sideboard games, you are still going to lose the matchup more than half the time. And if you can win 75% of sideboard games, you are just barely beating a break-even. Do you know why we worked so hard back in the day to build sideboards like the one in Kuroda-style red, which couldn't be conventionally interacted with, had all those Boseiju Who Shelters All, and anticipated and stepped around known sideboard cards? Because you actually have to win like 80% of the sideboard games to have any kind of reasonable expectation of winning a matchup with a negligible game one. Here's a cheat. To get to 80%, you almost always have to utilize an overload strategy or repositioning slash transformation or both. When your matchup isn't that bad, or even pretty good main, you obviously have to improve much less in order to close out wins with your sideboard. Remember, the opponent is a moving target, though. Keep that in mind when deciding how much space to devote to a matchup, as well as how important that matchup is. Corollary takeaway, it's very difficult to win a tournament, even with the best sideboard, when you're behind in game one to the deck to beat, if for no other reason that you are drawing in game three, and that's if you're lucky and not already dead.
Number three, bias practice games by starting with key cards in hand.
Grand Prix Orlando was one of the few tournaments in the era of Affinity where Affinity was not considered the absolute stone cold nuts. The main reason for this blasphemy, aside from sheer stupidity, was that people hadn't been playing Aether Vial in their Affinity lists up until this point, so decks like Mono Red and Blue Green Shards had relatively decent matchups against Affinity. Orlando changed all of that. I cruised through the Swiss with an Aether Vial list I got from Josh Ravitz via Yelgar Wiegersma. However, the best example of how unprepared for Affinity people were came in the top four, when I was paired against yet another Mono Red deck. I had managed to win game one rather quickly, yet my opponent didn't seem too concerned, as he stated, "I have a great sideboard against Affinity." The second game played out as follows. Turn one, him. Land, go. Me, land Aether Vial. Turn two, him. Land, go. Me, land, put a worker into play. Turn three, him. Land, go. Me, attack for one and put an Atog into play. Turn four, him, with a smile on his face from ear to ear, plays a fourth land and taps out to play Granulate. I sacrifice the worker to a Shrapnel Blast, untap, play a fourth, a Frogmite, and a Disciple, and kill him with the Atog. Lesson. Make sure your sideboard cards actually do something. Osip Levadovich. Remember what I said back in number one about picking a side? One thing you can do to really jazz up your side is to cheat in playtesting. Paul Jordan likes to make fun of me for cheating in playtesting. In public, I have mostly denied this, but I actually cheat quite vehemently. But I do it with very good reason. Especially back in the days when I used to play both sides of matchups for 20 hours a week on Apprentice, I would preload the deck I wanted to win with sideboard card X in its opening hand. This does a lot of things. First of all, it should help your deck win. Doesn't it feel great to win? Well, what if you don't win? Paul is in particular right, or at least looks funnier. If I lose in testing while cheating, remember Osip's opponent's Granulate? Do you think he would have been so smug if he had ever actually played a Granulate in testing? Biasing opening hands in testing not only gives you a potential sense of accomplishment that can be vital in order to keep going in your advocacy of a deck against the oppressive shadow of that heart-to-beat deck-to-beat, but it tells you whether your sideboard cards are good or not. How awful would it be to show up to a tournament, overvalue an opening hand based on the presence of a sideboard card, and then lose when you not only draw it, but play it? Isn't it better to learn that it sucks ahead of time? If you're biasing your hands and not getting the results you want, that can be a signal to abandon the deck or at least pursue a different line. If you are winning, that can be a signal to figure out how to consistently get the kinds of hands you have in front of you as you win sideboard games.
Number 4. Know what hands you can keep.
At the 1999 US Open, I was surprised to watch my friend John Schuler mulligan so aggressively. John was playing Malka Death, Saul Malka's Survival of the Fittest deck, years before he coined the term the Rock. John always seemed behind going to sideboard games. In particular, I was surprised to see him go to 5 cards on the play against a blue combo deck, while down a game. John further went to 4 cards by playing his Vampiric Tutor for duress. Yes, he won. In fact, he won all of them. John won the first US Open of 1999, splitting with Jamie Park in the finals. I asked him about his aggressive mulligans. Such were unheard of at the time. And he responded that you can never beat a blue control deck with the Rock unless you duress them. So you can only accept hands with duress or some proxy for duress, for example, Vampiric Tutor. The duress would buy a moment, and then John, if memory serves, bought even more with a boil, beat up the other guy with Spike Feeder or something before finishing US Nationals in the top 16 or so. Long story short, know what kinds of hands you can keep. You have very different criteria for keeping a hand in a sideboard game than you do in game one. Presumably, in a game one, you don't know what your opponent is playing, so your algorithm is probably around whether you have enough lands and spells to operate at a basic level. In a sideboard game, your algorithm is actually simpler. Can I win this game? I've become absolutely fearless around mulligans in recent years due in large part to the influence of Jerry Thompson. I'll mulligan to 4 or even 3, knowing that there is no point in griping about the loss of yet another card if my 5-card hand wasn't going to get there anyway. Remember, just one bullet ago, when we were cheating and playtesting, starting out with key cards, if you can only win the games where a key card is present, that is probably a signal for the strategic mulligan.
Number 5. Write down all the cards, where they were, and what they were doing.
It's one thing to lose games, and in particular game one. It's another thing to be able to win sideboard games. What contributes to losing game one, though? How do you know which cards were effective in sideboard games? If you write down all the cards you drew in game one and what zone they were in when you lost, you can gain a great deal of information. Is there a card that you decided pre-game or pre-testing was important, but was stuck in your hand as the 10th poison counter festered up your neck? That is a signal. How about a flagship creature? Where was it and how effective was it at what it was supposed to do? Goblin Guide is a good example. Many players snap leave in Goblin Guide because, hey, it's Goblin Guide. It turns out that there are a great many matchups where Goblin Guide, specifically on the draw, isn't very good. But if you don't isolate Goblin Guide's non-performance, you might never realize that your best first turn play on the play is actually kind of a dud going second, at least in this matchup. Writing down the cards that you drew when you win can also prove telling. If Lightning Bolt is great, why not Burst Lightning, etc.
Number 6. Play both Game 2 and Game 3.
This is probably hella not obvious to most people. You play a handful of games and declare a sideboard win percentage. Hooray. That's not actually how it works. Typically, Game 2 is a completely different animal from Game 3. For one thing, you're typically on the play in one and typically on the draw in the other if you've lost game one. That can change what cards are good. For example, Mana Leak is usually pretty good when you're on the play and loses much of its value when you're on the draw. So if your winning is contingent on having Mana Leak, very likely your performance will wane considerably in game three. Your opening hand
value... I have one quick note about that that I was just thinking of. We can circle back to it later. But one thing... that comes up a lot. I had a friend borrow a deck from me recently, and he asked for a sideboard guide.
Yeah.
And I just hate sideboard guides. I think they're terrible for people trying to get into decks because it's so often it's about like what cards you bring in, what cards you board out. But there's so much that can change between the game if you're on the player draw, right? Like, you might just have a, you might configure your deck completely different than game two and three.
Well, that's what I was talking about in this. I just want to quickly note, when we were, so last night, yourself and I were coaching Rebel Son, Rebel Jai, in her quest to be the third disciple of Flores to qualify with your blue-white control deck this season. And we were testing against Esper midrange, and she's like, well, the sideboard guards, this guy said to take out temporary lockdown, and I'm like, no, bring in the other temporary lockdowns. She's like, well, the sideboard guide say to take them out. I'm like, well, the sideboard guide writer is an idiot, right? And then, like, then we're playing, and she's like, why would you ever take out temporary lockdown? This card is destroying them, bro. I'm like, yes, I know. Don't listen to the idiot who wrote the sideboard guide.
Yeah, we can talk more about this later too. But in my weekend where I qualified,
yeah,
I played against blue black. Four times, three on Saturday in a row, and then one on Sunday when I won. And I was knocked out. The player who I beat in the finals of my Sunday tournament was the one who knocked me out of top eight contention on Saturday. But one thing that I took from that Saturday loss, as I took from Blue Black, was learning that, yeah, temporary lockdown's actually extremely good in the matchup. And I should have all three or all four post board against them.
I played four. I changed your sideboard. But I mean, just...
Yeah.
Again, my finals match, my last temporary lockdown took out two bats, three of the 2-1 fairies, and then, like, some number of maps, right? Like, it was devastating, right? Like, why would you not want to have that card in your deck, right? So, anyway.
Well, we can talk more about that later.
Oh, okay, anyway. So, back to the article. Your opening hand evaluations will also fluctuate depending on whether you are on the play or the draw. For example, in the fairies mirror... Broken Ambitions could serve as a passable Bitter Blossom proxy in terms of opening hand evaluation, if and only if you were on the play. On the draw, no Bitter Blossom usually meant a Snap Mulligan, especially if you didn't have Thoughtseize. Whereas on the play, you might keep an otherwise strong no Bitter Blossom hand if you had an answer to the opponent's Bitter Blossom in Broken Ambitions. Your Game 3 sideboarding strategy might be completely different. Your numbers might mess up your number 2 evaluation. You might even realize, over the course of many trials, that going second is where you want to be.
Number 7. Make your opponent a moving target, but don't overcomplicate things.
You have to keep it real. That's why number 6 suggested you practice games going second. Biasing your opening hands is a fine tool, but it has a specific goal, and that's not an implementation you can probably carry with you in tournament play. What does it mean to be a moving target? Your opponent very likely will have the tools to make some kind of improvement via sideboarding. Acknowledge those tools in playtesting, but don't overthink the problem. Remember, as an advocate, you're more concerned with the other deck's success than this one. The moving target assumptions you make in playtesting can become opportunities, not just threats. For example, in Critical Mass, sideboarding against Mono Blue, it came out that Critical Mass had only one target for Threads of Disloyalty, Sakura Tribelder. It is more or less pointless to leave in Threads for that decidedly terrible target. Knowing that our opponents had no Threads targets, we could side in Jushi Apprentice with impunity. Our opponents would have no good answer. If the opponent has left in Threads of Disloyalty, likely we aren't losing to him anyway. Then again, he might just have leveled us. As a final note, but not really a bullet, I would challenge all of you to seek uncertainty. So much of what we do in Magic is to try to establish a position of certainty. But the fact is, being certain of a loss is a kind of certainty too. Great sideboarding is just as often about breaking up the expectations of others as it is about getting your own plan on. Being able to look at the process from both perspectives, therefore, can expand the horizons of your possible plans. So go out there and make some awesome sideboards already. Love, Mike.
That was good.
That was the article, Roman.
I feel like I think this article is one of the most applicable to modern day Magic, I think. And of all the articles we've done, I think, for this podcast, I think this is actually one that sticks with me the most after just having read it. I think I've read it before, but I think it has the most applications because every single bullet point here is still will always be relevant in constructed Magic.
I love sideboarding so much. Like, at the point that I'd this is written 13 years ago at this point, but At the point that I'd written this, Chapin said something like, I had made 7 of the 10 best sideboards of all time. Like, it was like something like that. And I was, it was like such a compliment, you know? But I don't think that's probably true anymore. Like, there's been, you know, a lot of sideboards since then that have probably been pretty good. But yeah, I obviously approach sideboarding way differently than other people. And like, so like a lot of these things were just like really just keyed me off. Like the best one is I mentioned Kuroda Style Red. That was a deck that Josh Ravitz used to make the top 8 of U.S. Nationals, I want to say 2005. And the mono blue matchup was like unwinnable in game 1, but I made it so that it was unlosable in sideboarded games. And like, they sided in bribery, so part of our sideboard strategy was to side out all of our creatures. So we had like no, like we had a mono red deck with no creatures after sideboarding. So their bribery would miss. And so people de facto had boil. So like they would like side in like some equivalent of sleight of whatever it is, like that changes a color. So like you would just blow up your own land instead of like boiling all of their islands. Whatever magical hack, I think, is the name of the card. So like they would side in magical hack and bribery, and we would just have like, we didn't play boil, and then we had no creatures, right? So instead, our entire sideboard strategy was just based on siding in Boseiju and then just casting burn cards at them that were uncounterable.
Just like, yeah, that's sick.
It was like insane, right? Like they couldn't beat it because like their, because like their deck is all counter spells, but you have Boseiju, so your burn spells are uncounterable, right? Like, and then they're like, but what if, oh, I'm just gonna, you know, bribery your bomb like Arcslogger or whatever, but it wasn't in your deck at that point. It was so cool. And then Josh lost to Mono Blue in the top 8 because I explained the sideboarded strategy to Mark Herberholtz before the tournament, and then he told his friend who Josh played in the top 8. So so it's just like, no, it, you know, but I told Mark, you know, then Mark ratted on me. It should have been unbeatable. But it was, it's beatable if they, if the, back then there wasn't open deck lists. Can you imagine like to how crappy it is like in the open deck lists era? Like I put all this work into making a sideboard as like unbeatable against conventional mono blue deck, and then like now somebody can study it before they go into their game 2. Like it's just,
I mean, so crappy. I have a counterpoint to this.
Yeah.
At my regional championship in Atlanta when I played Pioneer, I played Blue White Control. I think in my sideboard, I had one copy of Settle the Wreckage. I can name.
I love you, I think, so much.
I
you
can
don't
name,
say anymore.
Like, yeah.
Don't say anymore. You said enough. You had one set of the Wreckage.
All right. Oh, but it was so.
Dude, it's yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Like, did you just tap your mana during combat a bunch? Like,
no, but.
Do the LSB?
Because people were, I played against like Convoke, Gruul twice, and I think there was like Arakdos aggro deck. And I had like 3 or 4 separate games where opponents did not make a move because they played around the settle. I had one match that I actually won when I did not have settle in my hand. Opponent didn't go for the alpha attack. And then the next turn they attacked and I had the settle.
Well.
It was sick. But
did you play Dream Trawler in that deck?
Yeah, it's the best card, like the best card in the main deck. And I'm surprised that people don't play Dream Trawler in their main deck.
Are you now going to switch your allegiance from Dream Trawler to Ezreum?
Not in Pioneer. I think Dream Trawler is too good, and I think Ezreum, the deck would have to be a lot different because we don't have like Deduce in the Pioneer version of the deck.
Yeah, or maps.
Yeah, I think
is there
also,
a Manland you play in the Pioneer version? Or do you play Celestial Colonnade, is that legal?
No. You play for what's called the 7/7 from the D&D set.
Hall of Storm Giants. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so the reason you wanted to do this one, and I will let you have the floor, Master Deck Designer, is you said, let's talk about killing our darlings. Why did you want to talk about killing our darlings?
So to give more context for this podcast episode, if you're not already aware, Michael J. and I both won RCQs in the last 2 weekends, both with Blue Light Control. I believe you played 32 out of 33 of the spells I played in my deck, but your mana base was a lot better because you played Matt Costa's version, which I'll concede is his mana was a lot better than mine. But the version I played, what was interesting about my tournament weekend was that I drastically changed a couple of key cards from my set between Saturday and Sunday. So I played two back-to-back RCQs. So the big thing with killing your darlings is I've had two copies of Jace the Perfected Mind in my main deck basically since the inception of the deck back in November, December of last year, where I originally, when people weren't playing the format as much, the kind of deck to beat was Domain, and I felt that Blue-White Control could not beat Domain before Murders at Karlov Manor. They could not beat Domain without having access to Jace game one. Because basically what the combo is you set up a game plan where your opponent's at 30 cards in deck, you resolve two Jace and mill them for 30.
So you played two Jace in your main deck at store championships that you made me play with you, and then I was stuck playing those Jace because you had played them for a long time, right? And
sure.
I bought your deck, right? Look, here's a celebrity deck designer, Roman Fusco. I'll play his, you know, celebrity deck design with, you know, three dissipates and whatnot. So I was, and I actually, the previous RCQ, I remember I asked you, you're just like, oh, you hadn't qualified yet, but you're like, I'm doing real well. I'll play blue white. I'm like, is there any new cards from the new set? And you like laughed at me. So I played the store championship version. I still made top eight undefeated in the Swiss, but
yeah,
I did not win. I lost to Karlov Manor cards.
my deck also changed a bit from the weekend prior to my RCQ weekend, which was when I top 16 the DreamHack Denver Sunday 5K standard event.
So, I mean, you're just on a sick run with blue white then. Store championship, yeah. Denver, and then
Denver.
And then a win.
I had like a random RCQ top eight before Murders came out, and then yeah, I had the weekend where I won.
So you would say killing your darlings is specifically removing Jace the Perfected Mind from the main deck,
right? Because I'll tell you more about that. So with Jace, I always wanted to have the deck designed around, my win con is Jace, I enact my gameplay in a way where I get to, they're at 30 cards, I have two Jace, I win the game. But I think what changed with Murders is that I started adding more cards, like Ezreum, for example, because we had Deduce, and I liked Ezreum as like a new Dream Trawler-esque card that could just win the game a lot faster, and it's Ezreum's pair is great with the Eternal Wanderer. But so when I played my RCQ on Saturday, I played against Blue Black three times in a row. And Ezreum was great. Eternal Wanderer was fantastic. But Jace was terrible. Jace didn't do anything. And I was talking... So when I got home from my RCQ Saturday night, I was on the phone with Adrian Sullivan talking about card choices and how to make my deck a little better. So the smaller changes were, I think I cut a card, the Confounded Nurgle that I had originally from my deck list the week prior.
It's like a 3-mana impulse.
Barf. Yeah, I was trying to have some sort of like dissipate counter spell still in my deck, but I think with Ezreum it just made no sense. I didn't need those types of cards anymore. Also with no more lies, so I instead put a fifth Surveil land in as my 27th land. I added Deduce to the deck. I think it was up to like two copies of Deduce. And then. Yeah, the big thing I talked about with Adrian that night was about Jace. And one example that he brought up was actually Ashiok Nightmare Weaver from his decks around like the 2015 era when I think he had a Pro Tour top eight.
Pro Tour top eight, yep.
Yeah, yeah. And what he told me was, you know, the number of Ashioks in his deck would wax and wane based on whatever week it was. So some weeks he'd have like four Ashiok, some weeks he'd have two, some weeks less. So one thing he said to me was, you might just go into the room tomorrow and your gut feeling, kind of based on what people are there, what you think they're playing, you might just cut Jace at the last moment for other cards. And that's literally exactly what I did. I got to the tournament. There was a bunch of people I knew on Convoke and Infect or Toxic. And I cut Jace last minute for one Destroy Evil, one, I think, Depopulate or Sunfall. I had three.
Oh, I did not play Depopulate. Depopulate sucks. Why would I ever play that?
Sure. Anyway,
it sucks.
I don't think it's that bad. My whole room was.
Have you ever read Sunfall? It RFGs all these guys that have buyback abilities and then leaves you a 6/6.
My room was like all Convoke. Luckily, I beat it and none of them made top 8. But the point is, I cut Jace for better cards.
Do you think Convoke is a tough matchup?
I didn't know. I mean, it was the first time I had played against Convoke in a tournament weekend. I played against it in round 2 and I easily won.
I mean, I've played against it so many times. I think like in the average universe, like blue-white of your style is something like 80% to beat Convoke. But I think that's just because the Convoke players don't know how to play. I wrote a whole article about it, actually. Like, I think it's actually super favors Convoke. They just play wrong.
I think so, too.
That is curable if you have my sideboard instead of your sideboard, though.
Sure. So, I remember in the finals match against Blue-Black, my opponent had resolved the Shieldred, and I think upkeep Memory Deluged, and I had exactly 2 mana left, and they were tapped out, and I found the Destroy Evil that would have been a Jace. And I remember out loud going like, holy crap, this is so much better than this is so freaking better than a Jace. And I killed the Shieldred and just easily and like just took over that game.
Yeah, so I think I wish we had killed the Darling of Jace all the way to 0 instead of having it in the sideboard. It's just like I played against Domain, I didn't even side it in.
Yeah, I played against Domain in my top 8. I won game 1 without Jace. Game 2 I lost, and then game 3, I actually like was on the back foot for a bit, and I actually did win with the Jace plan. But yep. I think also I should have just lost that game if my opponent had been more aggressive. So maybe I made some mistakes earlier on that wouldn't have got me to that point of my opponent having a kill. But I did win by casting both Jaces on the final turn of the game and having a battle for like 2 negates or something.
Because after you sent me your version where you had won the qualifier, I went into the lab, right? And I just started playing league after league, you know, training for the RCQ that I was going to play in. I remember texting you. I'm like, you know, I just keep beating Domain without Jace. Like, it's just, I don't think it's necessary. In my RCQ, I hit a clutch temporary lockdown. I could not win if it was any other card, right? So, I had like 10 mana. I Memory Deluge for temporary lockdown, kept me alive for a turn, and then I untapped and I hit Eternal Wanderer Ezreum, and that is pretty much unbeatable, right?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I still want to keep Jace around just because of how prevalent the mirror is right now. At least, I mean, I think it kind of depends on like where you're playing, what events you're playing in. Like my friend, for example, brought my deck to an RCQ and just like lost a bunch of blue white mirrors over the weekend. I think he won one, but like he was definitely feeling like because he didn't have as much experience with the deck as the other players, he felt heavily disadvantaged. And so, Jace was a way for him to win games that maybe he didn't have a shot.
It's a training wheels and other people might have it. I lost a game to blue white in the top four, where I had exactly 15 cards. My opponent beat me with Jace, but it's only because I screwed up. I had a turn where I didn't attack with a samurai, didn't attack with a might token, didn't use my Jace, and didn't make a might token all in one turn. And my opponent won with 2 life, and it was de facto 1 life because I could have made Wandering Emperor during combat to get an additional point in. So.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he only won because I had this disastrous turn where I, like, literally didn't use Wandering Emperor, didn't attack with a samurai, didn't make a might, and didn't attack with a might, right? So, but in my defense, like, this is, like, a pretty deep game, and I probably had 30 permanents on my playmat at that point, right? Like, it was just hard to keep track of everything. But
sure.
Regardless, he only, and I had 15 cards in my library. If I had 16 cards, I still would have won, right? And I just don't think it's good. I think that if those 2 Jaces were instead a second negate and a second disdainful stroke, that would have broader application. First of all, those would be broad applications in the mirror, right? They're good against opposing, right? Like Memory Deluge. and they can stop Jace, they
counter Jace. They're also good against Domain.
Yeah, and they're equally good against Domain, which is the where you want Jace anyway. I think if I were there to like train with your friend, I think he probably just doesn't understand how good your version is in the mirror. Like the reason that I played your version, like basically your spells stapled to Costa's mana base, is Costa's mana base is awesome in the mirror, right? And then your spells are awesome in the mirror, and like my initial, like even it's like similar to this article where just have these assumptions about like what cards are good or whatever, and I was like, oh, Costa's deck is probably better in the mirror because it doesn't have any cards like that people can interact with, right? It doesn't have any like Ezreum, it doesn't have like these big expensive planeswalkers, instead it has more card drawing and everything. And I didn't realize an opposing control deck just literally can't stop you from resolving Ezreum if you want to in a long game. So I would just like wait until I had 10 or 11 mana, and then I would just cast Ezreum and the Eternal Wanderer, and then my opponent would like, they would just be horribly behind at that point, right? Like they would have to like throw three, like routinely throwing multiple counter spells just to tap me out, and then main phase Sunfall or something, and at that point, right, they're down like six cards, you know, like it just to deal with one Ezreum. And that only happens because you have the Ezreum, right? And like if you're just like, oh, I'm gonna play like Union of the Third Path or Jace or something, like you just don't have that, like it's so powerful, Roman, right? Like in the mirror match, like it just resolves, your opponent basically has to Sunfall it, and if they, you know, if you win the fight over the Sunfall, God forbid, right? Like, they just can never win. You know, like, you just have a 5-5 unkillable that,
and you can,
you know,
you can
does
be
everything.
Smart about, and you can be smart about your sequencing, too, right? Like, casting deduces and not cracking the clues to leave them around for
maps or whatever. I was incredibly proud of myself. I lost that game one in the blue-white mirror in the top four. And in game two, I mulled to five. Right. And I mulled to five and I casted deduce and I got stuck on three and I never cracked the clue. Because if I ever cracked, I was stuck on three for like several turns. If I ever cracked the clue, he would have resolved Wandering Emperor or Memory Deluge. And like, I just did nothing, you know?
And did you have the counter in hand?
My hand was like Disdainful Stroke and two No More Lies. So, my hand was scripted to not crack the clue.
Right. Do you think right? that, like, but I remember one thing you mentioned to me was that I think a lot of players in that situation would crack the clue because, you know, a big notion of the control mirror is you have to hit your land drops, right?
Yeah.
But how catastrophic is it then if you try and hit your land drop and they resolve a Wandering Emperor and you just lose the game?
No, you lose the game, yeah. Like, I mean, that's the end of my tournament, right? Like, instead, I just played super conservatively, and the other thing is, it's also behind, like, at the point where I hit my land drops, like, I was also behind, like, two Memory Deluges to none, right? Like, I just, you know, but, like, it's just the resource management at that point, right? Like, what can I catch with these counter spells, you know? And then I just lived, you know, I just lived long enough to, you know, from resource management to cast Ezreum. And then, you know, in sideboarding games, they have fewer ways to deal with Ezreum.
Right, yeah.
But you did a good job.
Not that many ways to deal with the Wandering Emperor, the Eternal Wanderer.
All right, so do you want to talk about this article, or you just want to brag about how good of a deck designer you've become in 2024?
We can do both, right?
Yeah.
We can do a little bit of both.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I think I want to go back to the article a bit, because I think what's one thing that's interesting about just practicing Magic is how often do you think that like people playtest in paper these days? Probably not that often anymore, right?
I playtest in paper a lot.
Well, I'm sure you do, but I wonder
like
if like the newer
main
players
thing I
are
do with my friends.
No, I'm sure that you do. Maybe some of the better players do this. But I wonder, you know, do people miss out by playing Arena,
okay,
or by playing
a
MTGO?
A few months ago, you came to visit me. How many days did we spend together?
Two or three?
2 days. of the 2 days we spent together, how like what percentage of our waking hours were spent playing Paper Magic?
A lot.
Like, Saturday, we just playtested all day, and then Sunday, you won a tournament, and then we both played Paper Magic, yeah. Right? Like, yes, I mean, like, two for
we
two.
Got, we, like, got Korean barbecue with Rebel and
D-Tal.
And D-Tal. Yeah.
And then we and then and after then played, that, we literally played hours of Paper Magic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to answer your question, yeah, like, one of the reasons I, you know, got the studio where I did is, like, I live really near D-Tal, and D-Tal always hosts us playtesting sessions. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, I hang out with D-Tal or whatever. So,
like, when you practice pre-modern, are you doing, like, this bias playtesting when you're having sideboard cards in your hand to start off matches or games?
It depends on the sesh, right? So, if it's just me and Lanny, we just test really hard, right? We'll just try a bunch of things. If it's other people, we usually play like kind of a bridge tournament structures and then see which decks do well and then kind of iterate from there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's different. You can't do it with like five people.
Right, right. I think another bullet point that stuck out to me for this article is number five, write down all the cards, where they were and what they were doing. I think one thing I see at kind of the local level with Paper Magic these days is people just kind of put whatever cards they want in their sideboard or their main deck without, I think, really playtesting them or having, I guess, a reason for them, right? Like, I think you need to have a pretty strong reason for every card in your main deck and your sideboard.
Last night, you and I were both trying to simultaneously coach Rebel, right? And we did not do a good job. Did not do a good job because
we would have separately done
a good job, but I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, I literally won four of my last five leagues and 7-1 or better, and the other one was like a 5-2.
Both made suggestions that were like game losing play
in consecutive games. I'm like, no, do this, and then she did the other thing, and you're like, no, do this, shut up, Mike, and then she did your play. It was like, so
catastrophic.
To us both coaching at the same time was literally catastrophic. The thing that I would say is there was one game that she lost that she had two no more lies in her hand at the end of the game, and I don't know if you remember that. It was in the Esper testing, and if I had not just been fighting with you over what decisions to make every round, I probably would have noted that, right? Like, I vividly remember it now because we went through this article. The fact that she lost a game with two no more lies in hand at the end of the game was actually very, very interesting to me.
I mean, right? We did play against Esper. We played a couple games versus Esper where we had Ezreum, and Ezreum was, like, not pulling his weight. And, you know, we talked about how good Ezreum is in that matchup post board.
I also think, like, Rebel came to her own conclusions about how good, like, Temporary Lockdown and the Eternal Wanderer are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
And, like, those cards are really powerful.
Well, I think Rebel initially was like, oh, we board out the Eternal Wanderer, right? We're like, no, you can't.
No, keep it's it in. So good. And so she was even like,
how you win.
Yeah, like, Farewell is good. I'm just not a big fan of, like, just the vanilla 1-for-1 removal when the opponent's deck is just nothing but 2-for-1s, right? Like,
sure, and then,
don't
Farewell was decent.
That's fine. You just need something to resolve, right? They don't have an unlimited number of counterspells, you know?
Yeah, like, they have
once
six.
Something resolves, then you catch up and you land a Planeswalker, right? Like, that's the way it goes. And that's the way I would try to plan it, right? Like, I think if you're trying to just play card, you know, lineup theory, card for card with them, their cards deal damage and draw extra cards, and your cards are just like kill a thing, make two maps. Like, you're not gonna win, right? Like, you're giving them two maps, and like, you're always killing a creature that just drew a card, you know? Like, you need to overwhelm them, I think.
I think so too. And this kind of goes going back to trying to tutor my friend. I think what's interesting is, like, maybe the important lessons to learn initially aren't just, like, what cards do I bring in, what cards do I port out in this matchup. It's, like, what are cards doing? How are they interacting with your opponent's cards? Like, what what are the important exchanges happening in the match? And like that will give you a better perspective, I think, on how to sideboard on the fly during a match in a tournament, as opposed to like looking at a sheet of paper and saying, okay, it's a, the paper says to do this, to take out five cards and bring in these five cards, right?
How prepared did you feel for the regional championship that we played together in San Diego last year?
Not prepared at all.
See, I felt
even
really
though we
prepared.
Yeah,
you know, like
I mean, I felt prepared with a deck that we were testing, but I
and then you
I
changed decks at the last minute.
Yeah,
I mean, I didn't do well probably, with the deck we tested, so I can't, you know, really.
No, I mean,
really argue over it, but the thing that I would say is I think I had a false sense of preparation because like I was just playing Arena, right? And like, you know, I'm used to playing Leagues, and then I can't remember who. I think it might have been Lanny. It was not because like Lanny criticized me for preparing on Arena at all. And he's like, at least you should do a Mythic run, right? And then I was just like, you know, top Mythic in like 2 days, you know, 2 months in a row testing for the RC. But then like I realized later, like that's just not good enough. If you like if you test in paper, like I learned a lot of cheating strategy from Brian Kibler. So like cheating and playtesting, I mean, not like cheating, like neither of us cheats in real life, right? Like, but cheating and playtesting. So one of the things Kibler taught me was just like treat all of your lands as City of Brass that don't deal any damage. What happens if you treat all of your lands as City of Brass that don't deal any damage? What happens? You know, what horizons open up? It's that kind of thinking that created his deck, The Red Zone, which he made top four of Pro Tour Chicago in, I want to say, 2001, which, like, everybody else was playing a red-green Fires deck. He played a red-green deck with a lot of the same cards, but instead of Fires, he had white for Armageddon, and then, like, his like a ton of black sideboard cards that were, like, so he was, like, cloaking up Rith the Awakener with Armadillo Cloak, you know, and other people mm-hmm. were like, just didn't even fathom that this was an available play line, right? Like, and then he had Sabo's Decree. Do you know what that is?
No.
It's a instant speed black removal spell that you name a creature type, and it kills all of the things of that creature type in play and all of the things of that creature type in your opponent's hand, right? Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so it is like, and just like the idea that he had that card, and like other people just, it wasn't even on their playables list, right? And one of the main decks of the tournament was Rebels, right? Like, so, yeah, so like most Rebels decks had like an advantaged matchup against like, you know, red green Fires type decks because they could like search up these Rebels that were very good at blocking, right? But what happened, like, it also hits the ones in your hand, so you can't even sandbag, right? So, like, it was, like, insane, right? And he has this deck where, like, you know, he's playing, like, a symmetrical matchup where, like, both players have Blastoderms or whatever, and he's just Armageddons. It's like, imagine you're playing a symmetrical matchup, like, we're playing the exact same cards, right? Like, you have 5/5s and 3/3s, and I have 5/5s and 3/3s. You're not going to expect me to play a symmetrical card like Armageddon, right? Because I might be behind. But Kibler has this understanding that, like, you won't think that I will do that because I might be behind. Oh. But because you have that presupposition, I can take the opportunity. I can take the opportunity to use a card like that and then just win with a massive advantage because of how you played, right? So he has this mindset of, like, treat every land in playtesting like it's a City of Brass that doesn't deal any damage and then see what happens. That's how you get to the good deck design. Or like, you know, my thing is just like, just start with the sideboard cards you want. Because if you can't win the games that you start with the sideboard cards you want, then your deck probably can't win the matchup. That's really kind of where you get to.
Quick question with that. So when you're starting with these sideboard cards, have you played games where you'll start with like a sideboard card in a different color just to test it out and see what happens?
Yeah, like we played black sideboard cards in our mono red deck, for example. So
that's
how we got.
That's like.
So if you look at like the 2005 mono red deck that Josh Ravitz played, right? The mana base has one swamp and four Tendo Icebridge, and the deck is mono red. So it has one swamp that we could search for with, there's this very terrible land searching artifact, right? But our deck had Shrapnel Blast, so like we just play this shitty artifact. Because you could Shrapnel Blast with it anyway, right? But you could get the one swamp in a sideboard game, and we had 4/10 Weiss Bridge. So we could cast black sideboard cards that allowed us to win the matchups that a mono red deck couldn't win. Like,
gotcha.
That, so, like, that's the kind of stuff. And, like, Standard was slower back then, right? So, you know, I don't know if you have the time to cast forecasts and cost black sorceries that don't deal any, you know, effect on the battlefield today, right? But back then we had time to do it and disrupt our opponent's game plan. So the answer to your question is yes.
That's cool. And
I think that's how people get to certain places in like pre-modern, where like you have like a blue-white 12/12 deck instead of a mono-blue 12/12 deck, right? You know, or blue-black 12/12 deck instead of a mono-blue 12/12 deck.
And I wonder if like that's something that when I, you know, build, because like the blue-white deck I built a long before people were playing blue-white in the format, and I wonder like what I think there still are a lot of avenues in modern day Magic to explore deck building and get a leg up before other people can do it. I mean, in the DreamHack tournament that I played in, right, I went like 5-0 and then double drew into top 8. I had like 3 or 4 people throughout the day go like, can I get your list? I've never seen, like, you seem like so prepared for the event. I play against a green black opponent who I beat and asked me for my list, and he said like, you just like trounced me. You knew what you were doing the whole time, and you just like made a mockery of my deck essentially. And because he had just never seen anyone have like the configuration of cards that I did. Right?
Did you get him with Ezrim the Eternal Wanderer?
I did get him with Ezrim. I don't know if I cast the Eternal Wanderer in those games, but like the games were not close. And you know, it was, I think, a really gratifying and rewarding experience for me to come out of that tournament feeling that I felt very far ahead. And I mean, that like what happened is, I mean, I've read about this a lot and posted on Twitter, but I had to concede my finals match against Toxic to make my flight. granted, I won the week, you know, next weekend, but that tournament was one of the tournaments where I felt just so, you know, even when I won also, I felt very in tune with my deck and my decisions.
Look, we make a point, I think you wrote about this recently, like, but we make a point to have like no permanent allegiances, right? Like that's supposed to, that's our brand. We have no permanent allegiances. But the reality is everybody thinks about me as a mono red player, right? Like,
thinks about me as a burn player in modern and a control player in standard or pioneer. Whatever.
No, but like people just think that I'm a burn player in all contexts, right? Like Saul Malka, who's known me since, I don't know, 90s, like 97, I think is when we first hung out the first time, which is like 27 years ago, asked me if, you know, people were surprised that I wasn't just attacking with a Monastery Swift Spear with a Monstrous Rage on it. And so, like, I mean, I was going to ask you, like, do you feel as yourself, I mean, again, putting aside the fact that we are players with no allegiance, do you feel, like, you know, do you feel that to be true? Like, you're a blue-white player in Standard and a red player in Modern, or, you know,
what? You know, I don't know. I think it's because I don't play, like, it's weird because I don't actually play a lot of Magic, I think, outside of playing Limited. Like, when I
play, every time I want to record a podcast, you're drafting, so I don't know how you could not play a lot of Magic.
No, I play a lot. I just said I play a lot of Limited.
Okay.
But, like, when I went 10-4 at, I went 10-4 at my regional championships, right? I got 49th, and, you know, that's, I don't know, 17 slots away from a Pro Tour invite or whatever, and it was one slot away from an RC requalification. I played 0 games of Magic or Pioneer to prep for that tournament. Like all I focused on was my deck configuration. This is actually kind of relevant to this article. I spent the time in testing, quote unquote, configuring my deck and picking my sideboard cards and tightening my list up, and that felt a lot more relevant to me than actually playtesting. I mean, I think there were times where, yeah, if I had playtested more, I maybe would have won some of the matches that I lost, and I would have had kind of better reads on lines. But here's an example of that tournament. I was so sure of Dream Trawler, and I love that card in the main deck of blue-white, that I played against Oliver Tomiko when we were both 5-0 in day one, and I resolve a Dream Trawler. He's playing Phoenix, and he just instantly conceded. Like, and the match was over in like 9 minutes. But I felt so sure of, like, you know, how good Trawler was against Phoenix and Rakdos, which are two big decks of that tournament, that, you know, it didn't take me having to play test games to win those matches.
Is Seed Shark great in Pioneer? Like, a Phoenix doesn't.
Oh, get hell yeah. Seed Shark, yeah. Right? No, in game two, I resolved Seed Shark and then cast, like, resolved a Farewell and the game was over.
Like, yeah, that seems fantastic.
He lost the game with, like, Treasure Cruise in hand, and I attacked him for, like, 11 two turns in a row. Because I had marched the turn prior, which got countered, but I marched for extra mana, so I got a 5 Incubate. And then I think I marched a Ledger Shredder, but I did, like, X equals...
4
instead of 2. Yeah, sure. And then I cast Farewell the next turn, which resolved. I got then I'm like, okay, I'll attack you for 11. You can't do anything.
Well, that just reinforces my opinion of Phoenix and Pioneer. I think that deck sucks.
Well, it's so sad because I think Dream Trawler is a card that blue-white players should be playing more copies of, because I think that card is just so awesome, and it solves a lot of problems in a number of matchups that are close, but I never see anyone play it. I love that card.
You can just be the Dream Trawler, man.
Maybe I am. No one plays Ezreum in Standard.
Ezreum is great. I mean, I tweeted about it. I'm like, I just would never have guessed this card was any good, right? It's actually fantastic.
Well, and it was nice to play with it a bit before my DreamHack tournament. And I just was able to compare it so easily to Dream Trawler that, you know, with playing Deduce and Celestis and Anchorages, you're going to have just random artifacts in play, right? And it turned out to be really good. And I think, but my notion of the card before I even played it was not, this card doesn't, you know, is whatever. It seemed like a pretty probable contender for the deck, and I'm glad that it ended up being really good, and it was really good for you, obviously.
Yeah, your deck's great. It's just absolutely great. Also, like, I beat Mono Red a bunch today in just, like, ranked matches, so I don't even know what to say anymore. Like, I don't know what to say. Because that was supposed to be, like, bad matchup, right?
Sure, yeah.
I beat it like 3 times today.
It's nice to be in the conversation. It's nice to be the deck designer for once.
Dude, you got it, man. Like, I think that Costa's getting, like, a lot of credit. But I think his mana base is great. Like, it's just, it's.
I agree too.
But, like, his spell configuration is much weaker than yours, in my opinion, right? Like, I mean, the main difference is did you not play the Depopulate even though you said you did? I was a little confused over that point.
I played Depopulate in my RCQ that I won.
Okay, so I played 4 Sunfall because Sunfall's great and Depopulate sucks, and then I played 1 Deduce instead of the Celestis. And then I think I told you, like, my friend made top 8 just, like, riding the Celestis to win a blue-white-ish mirror because the opponent just couldn't deal enough damage. Like, it was gas.
The card's so good.
Yeah, he was playing Esper and Esper Planeswalkers, and the opponent was playing blue-white.
Yeah.
But, you know, blue-white-ish, right? So he got him. It was awesome because he was going to lose, and the Celestis just kept him alive. And then he drew a Siphon Insight and won the game by Siphon Insighting his opponent to death. So it was a cool way to win. What do you want to talk about? Or are we gonna call it?
I think we've talked about enough. We can wrap it up. We're at an hour.
All right. Look, I think we shouldn't only podcast when you have a RCQ to
play. We win.
But I would podcast all the time. I would podcast as soon as we get off of it, so we can start another episode if you want. But, you know, I think, you know, the people love this podcast. I love this podcast. And, you know, I'm glad you got a chance to brag. You really are the master deck designer right now. I'm so happy to be your friend and to have gotten the inside track, because honestly, I would not have qualified if not for this. Like, I don't know if I would have even played in the qualifier. I was going to play a Popper 1K that day, and you know, my RCQ was a 2K, so it was a 2K, and it was big because it was a 2K, so it was a 6-rounder Swiss, which is pretty big for RCQs these days. I played the Roman Fusco special, and I lost no matches. I only lost 3 games the entire day, and I should have won at least 2 of them. One of them I punted with Field of Ruin. I tapped my Field of Ruin on a Wrath turn and took 2 points of damage from a man land that I didn't have to. He drew Shielder the next turn, so I died. All I had to do is just not tap the Field of Ruin there, and I win that game. And then I lost the game in the top 4 where I forgot to use Wandering Emperor, attack with a Samurai, attack with a Mite, and use Myrix all in one turn. So those were both winnable games.
I'm shaking my head. You can't see it, but I'm shaking my head.
Yeah, so I probably should have won the other game too. I didn't know what frilled throwback is, that whatever that thing is.
Oh yeah, I know what you're talking about the 33 guy.
I didn't know what that card did. The first time it ate my Memory Deluge, and then the second time it killed my temporary lockdown, like getting back like 3 creatures. And so like I just literally just didn't know what the card did, and it beat me.
So it's okay.
Like it's okay. maybe that's winnable if I just know what cards are in my opponent's deck. But I'm like, this like 3/3 is just destroying me. I got the next 2. It was fine. But yeah, great job, and I hope people like the article.
Yeah, I hope so too. And we'll be talking a lot more about Standard as we approach our shared regional championship come May.
The people at home, I want you to know, I've like already curated like 6 articles for us to work on that I sent to Roman, and I assume we will record more of them in the future.
That is the plan, so stay tuned.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, bye.